Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast, broadcasting from the oldest grace-based web presence in the universe, and presenting the Christianity Free Gospel. This is Daniel Rouse. Would you welcome with me again the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, Michael Lilborn Williams.
Good morning, afternoon, good day, my dear friend, Daniel. You know what? I'm going to skip the weather forecast because after I listened to our last show, I think you cut it out anyway.
I don't think so.
How dare you remove my weather report?
No, I think what happened on that one is we actually recorded back to back, and so I think you already gave the weather report for the day.
Oh, that's what happened.
And you were just so excited to jump right into it.
There was there's always layers of accuracy about a situation. See, I looked at that and said, wow, there's no weather report in this one because I didn't listen to it till it came out. It's like, did he take our weather report out? Oh, man. See, I almost had you guilty of a crime that is beyond a misdemeanor. We must do the weather report. It's bright and sunny, and I'll be damned if it's not cold here again in Tennessee for late April. It is cold. Oh, we'll survive.
You'll survive.
Yeah.
Jeez. Summer's coming.
It has to. We've had a goodness. It has been a good week. The one thing I do love letting people know is my sister's doing well. She's just a happy little lark. It's just, she's taught me so much. You know, her ability to connect, you know, a conversation, what you just said or what she just said, or even, you know, really knowing what she's saying is just pretty well gone. And, but she will do what she does with a smile, with a laugh, and is constantly concerned about those around her and the ones that aren't here. She's concerned about them too. And, there's always a lot of people around that we haven't seen in, you know, 40, 50 years, say in some cases, but she's wanting to make sure everybody's got a bed, everybody's got a place to sleep, everybody's got enough food, and it is constant. She is the consummate server. She serves and she's even serving people that have been gone for years and years and years. It is a whole different world. I can't even remember the world I used to live in compared to the world that I live in now. But and I know a lot of people who have been, especially those that have been caregivers, know how restrictive it can be. But I tell you what, gosh, she's in her 14th year of Alzheimer's, which she's in final stages of this. But I can tell you that I really love staying here with my sister. This has been, it's been a very special thing, very wonderful thing to happen in my life. So, but all of you that do get concerned for a lot of reasons, just know that I'm okay. And I always want you to know, you know, that my sister's doing really, really well. She's doing good. The disease is the disease. It's a horrible disease. You have to forget about that part of it and enjoy the moments. She keeps me laughing. There's things that she says that would absolutely crack you up. And she'll laugh about them too. And they're just so otherworldly, you know, and just quips and things that she says that we've learned to just enjoy her being herself where she is right now, not expecting something more out of her than where she is. And she's just delightful. She's just one of the most delightful people in the world.
And how about Mr. Don, any reports on Don? Or I know we had some of our partners and different ones have reached out to offer help. Are we still looking for any help and assistance as far as Don's concerned?
I tell you what we are to now. We went down one route, which was such a generous offer from one of the GRs to supply them with a place to stay. They even changed out the floors from carpet to hardwood to accommodate. Laura is pretty well wheelchair bound or on a walker, which a carpet and that just doesn't mix. And so a heartfelt and not just heartfelt, but action to the heartfelt desire to help out. And we were moving forward with that. But boy, the closer we got to it, the more we looked at the particulars of Dawn's needs and her needs. I think that the level of care needed is greater than what can be done there in Minnesota. So here's where we are. And I'll take just a moment to do this so that everybody can know where we are. Dawn's have been up and down. He's gotten to where he can take a few steps and then he's back in his bed and hadn't been out of bed in days. And then, you know, he'll try again. There's been so many setbacks with this issue with COVID. It is just such a horrible plague. What we finally come up with is the best thing is for them to be able to stay in their home. Now, to stay in their home, though, they are going to have a live-in caregiver, someone that lives there with them in the house and would be provided room and board. They'll provide the food and a room, but they have to be there at the house with them. Of course, there would be scheduled times off. Nobody can do this 24 hours a day. I can attest to that. So if there's any of you guys out there that you're going to have some training, some experience and or training in dealing with different medical has to be some, not a great part. You don't have to administer shots or anything like that. It does require some awareness or some experience in dealing with someone who is recovering. So if there is anyone that you want to just take 3 months out of your life and help them get settled in their home, you wouldn't even have to make a permanent commitment to this. If you wanted to take a couple of months and say, I want to come up and live with Don and Laura, and they're also offering, you know, a monthly payment for that. And if you, you know, want to make some money, if you now if you're a nutcase, please don't apply. And you guys know which ones of your nutcases. Hey, this is a gospel revolution. We don't try to hide that we've got nutcases. And probably one of them starting right here in the secret city. If you know that this is not something that you have the ability to do, the personality to do, it's not time. We're at a time where we really need people who are capable and able to do this on several levels. So if anybody has, or you know somebody who might be able to do something like this, and like I said, we can do it on a short-term basis, whatever somebody would like. But there's got to be a transition of Don and Laura back to their home. And then we'll go from there and see what becomes necessary for their care.
Yeah, hearts go out to Don. And I know he still listens to the podcast. So, Don, just know that we love you and we are ever so anxious to have you back in the saddle. We need your brain.
Yeah, I told him, I said, I know you're laying there in bed and it's been 8 months COVID, but I'm still going to milk you for everything I can. And he said, hook up the machines. Hook up the machines. So, and we do. Goodness gracious. I still run things by him and Daniel, both. And there's times when, and even when we find things that I did not know, I just was on the phone with him yesterday, telling him something that we had found. Let's just go ahead and start with this, because I think it's a little mind teaser. It was for me, and we were looking at the fact that the veil was torn in the temple, and it's like, so what does that mean? Did somebody, you know, of course the earthquake happened. It seems to attribute that the earthquake split this thing in two. It's like, why would an earthquake split a curtain in two? Wouldn't the curtain just sway or, you know, slide down the rod or, you know, what happened with this thing? I started doing some research into it. And there, of course, there's been a lot of research into the temple and what it was and how it operated and how it was constructed. And the first thing I found out is I think it was 30 cubits high, which is 60 feet. That's approximately, if you give 10 feet per story, that's approximately a 6-story building, right?
Wow.
And so, and it says that the curtain went from the very top height of the temple all the way down to the floor. So this curtain, number one, was 6 stories high. It was woven. There was purple. It was very colorful, evidently, according to the description I read. And there is no biblical verse that tells you how thick it was. I've read anything from as thick as a man's hand to up to 4 inches thick. So it's not something that you'd be able to tear in two very easily, for sure. The other thing we learned about it was that it was changed out. Now, this one's got me intrigued. It was changed out once a year. It wasn't like they hung one up and then they waited until that one wore out and then they put another one up, you know, when the curtains got bad like we do. This thing, regardless of its condition, was changed every year. Now, what we don't know is, was it changed? Now, we do know that it was changed at Passover. We don't know if it was changed just before the sacrifice or just after the sacrifice. Now, Don told me that the Passover, that what Jesus was going through during that weekend was the follow-up to the Passover, which actually took place on Wednesday before. And so the actual sacrifice for the animal sacrifice would have taken place on the Wednesday before. Of course, Jesus is, you know, we got the quote, what we call in the Christian world, Good Friday, and then him dying. So 3 days later, after this sacrifice, then comes this sacrifice on the hill outside of Jerusalem. So I've been trying to think my way through this. It's like, so this thing, I'm sure that there had to be a task, you know, like the women's curtain group, you know,
auxiliary.
Yes. The women's temple curtain auxiliary group meets every day, all day long to get a new, 6-story high curtain. We don't know how wide yet. I'm sure we can find that out. Ready to go for next year. Well, this curtain was torn from top to bottom, and whether it was replaced just before the new sacrifice for the next year was coming up, or it was replaced just after, this thing was brand new. It wasn't more than 4 days old, regardless of where you put it. And it gets torn from top to bottom. Don't you know the ladies' auxiliary for curtain maintenance? Jesus, what must have happened here? The frenzy. We don't think about these behind the scene things. And that's what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to walk through this in Jerusalem with you The other thing we talked about, as Daniel and I were discussing last night, was that everything continued in the temple. You know, they did not stop, as is confirmed by the fact that James had Paul go in. And now this is some 10, 15 years later. I think there's pretty accurate numbers as to when that took place, but it was years later. And they obviously were still offering sacrifices. They were still going through purification rites. The temple was still being used as a temple. The temple didn't shut down when Jesus died on the cross. So James was in the temple every day. We know at least that he was praying. I read one historian said he had a throne set up. I'm not able to confirm that, but one of the historians say that he had a throne set up in the temple, and which that was before I even started into the lineage and realized why he would have done such a thing if he did and do that. But we do know he was in the temple praying three times a day. So he was around all of this. This was animal sacrifice going on. All of these things continued up until 70 AD. When the temple was destroyed, they would not have stopped it. I know they probably did not have a backup curtain ready. I'm sure it took another year to get another one ready. They probably already had it on the yarn table or whatever it was that they, wherever they worked to do this. They most likely somehow stitched this thing back together from top to bottom if it was torn. So we want to portray to you what the reality was on the ground, is that things continued as they had been for centuries in the temple after the crucifixion of Jesus. They continued right on. Somehow they got this curtain back together, and without question, they did that. Because like we say, we've got this some 15 years later, of them going through the animal sacrifices. And now this curtain, though, that was torn, they only went behind it once a year. And only one high priest got to go behind this curtain once a year. So anyway, that's just a little on the ground. You know, we're taking our drone and we're flying around inside the temple, kind of looking to see what's actually was going on at the time.
I just as you were talking, the only thing I could think of is if Bob Tilton or Benny Hinn were around in the day that the curtain was torn in two. I can just see the campaign. Get your 1-inch by 1-inch prayer cloth. And it was the actual veil between the holy place and the holy of holies. And for your $1,000 seed, we will send you.
They would have either been cutting it up and selling it or taking up a collection to mend it. One of the two. Yep. But a collection there would have been, no doubt. But I think it's important for us to realize that temple life had continued here in Jerusalem. So we know that there were believing Jews, but there were also many thousands of Jews that had not believed that were there still. And even the Christian Jews, that's the only thing I know how to call them because they really were Christians. They were still practicing all of these things as per James would have instructed them to. Circumcisions, all of these things were still taking place. That's what they were mad at Paul about. Because he was telling people that they did not have to observe the laws of Moses. That's why he had to be go through the purification rites. As James said, that this will prove that those things which thou sayest is not true.
Mm.
So that's why people say, why? Well, Paul knew when he was going through it, it was to prove, according to James' decree, that Paul's teaching wasn't true.
And I think the other thing to point out in that is, with these three groups, you got the Jews, the non-believing Jews, the believing Jews, and then you have the Gentiles, or the believing Gentiles, if you will. And there was a lot of politics, religion, whatever. There was a lot of institutionalization between these three groups. And they were, I mean, I think that's the very thing that's being dealt with here as we go through Galatians is, do we take these Jewish traditions and force them upon the believing Gentiles?
Yeah.
And I think the non-believing Jews had such a strong force and such a strong name that I think they even persuaded some of the believing Jews to do more than what they were doing. They were trying to get them back under, because I read just last night, I read through, you know, half of the book of Acts, and I was just watching how these three different groups interacted. And it seemed like the further along you got in the story, the more violent that the non-believing Jews became. And yes. I think they really had a lot of persuasion on, and perhaps even James and Peter and Paul, at, you know, the purification rites. And Peter, you know, Peter, at one point, he was brought into question about eating with the Gentiles by the Jews. And then we just covered last week how Paul rebuked him for the opposite. So yeah. there's a lot of drama going on between these
pressure.
Yeah.
So the one thing that I, that Daniel's bringing out to you is that we're wanting you to understand that we're trying our best not to sit in condemnation of any of these guys. I can't even imagine being in their shoes and their time and their place. Now, the gravity of the fact that they had walked with him and talked with him a long life's narrow way, that perplexes me. That it was Jesus himself who told Peter what to do in these situations and what not to do in these situations. And he completely rejected. But the thing with Peter that you have to acknowledge, I don't think you have to respect it, but you have to acknowledge was that he didn't just do this behind Jesus's back. He did it to his face.
Right.
He told Jesus point blank, I will not do what you're telling me to do. Gosh, it's been more than 40 years ago that I realized that everything, every encounter that Peter had with Jesus, he had to be told three times and no other character. And then you pointed out when we were talking that Paul kind of must have known that about him because Paul said two times in chapter one, let them be accursed. I mean, it's the exact same quote two times in a row. And I remember when you pointed it out, I didn't catch the irony of that. But because he knew this guy was kind of thick in the head somehow. You got to say it more than once. If he didn't listen to Jesus, I got to say it at least twice. In fact, if you read on down through it, he did say it three times. Not in the same words, but the third time he went into detail and explained why.
Yeah.
And what he was actually talking about. So, and yes, we've been through the Galatians. I've replaced my series on Galatians at least three times over these decades. And here in the last 2 years, we've 2 to 3 years, I've taught through the book of Galatians possibly three times. And I don't know if this is the third or the fourth, but I doubt that it will be the last because there is so much here. If you will, as you listen, put yourself there in Jerusalem, in the middle of this conflict, in the middle of this derision. You know, we've gone through some pretty difficult things based on groups against groups right here in America on several issues, and try to amplify that to as high of a degree as you can above what we've seen happen here in our own situation, and think about how much you are pressured and feel pressured by other groups about where you stand on a particular issue. Now, amplify that as much as possible. And I think that gives us a little bit more of a merciful view. I do know that I've not been very merciful to Peter and John. I still really don't have any at all for James because James was solidly, James had no confusion about where he stood. He wanted power. He wanted authority. He wanted control. And he stayed in the seat of control without leaving throughout the rest of his life to maintain it. So even with all the sacrifices going on around him, even with all the temple things that were totally contrary to what his brother had accomplished, and he continued with it, not only continued with it willingly, he participated and encouraged others to participate.
There was definitely a lot happening and going on there. And what do you say, Michael? Should we continue our study in Galatians and move on? I think we made it through chapter 2. Chapter 3, you know, I think we had started off intending to only go through chapter 2, but with some of our recent discoveries and with the help of Robert May, we are pulled right in, I think, even to go all the way through.
Yeah, we have no choice now. Robert May hooked the train up all the way to chapter 4, so we have no clue except to go through each one of these boxcars and go through each one of them and see what they have to offer us. Chapter 1 and chapter 2 have been very clear. This was a plot, Paul has described. This was a deceptive, underhanded plot that was being carried out, inspired by James. Paul made it very clear who the inspiration behind it was. Peter and John. We also know that it was such a strong deception that was going on that even Barnabas, Paul's own traveling companion, was drawn away into this deception to the point where that they were doing what Paul said, spying out our liberty. We'll go as far as to tell you that the question was about circumcision, and that is determining whether some man has been circumcised or not, and they were to check. They are trying to check out who was and who was not circumcised. Now you figure out how they were doing that, because we're. but that's what Paul says they were there doing. There's just no way around it. You can't get around it. That's just where religion can take you, to where you'll do really bizarre things to try to accuse somebody or find out whether or not they are obeying your rules or not. And then one of our great pickups on this also was Paul's entire rebuke of Peter, which was more than just the last part of verse 14, but instead lasted as a rebuke of him and the things that Peter seemed to have as either never known or has forgotten or has confused. That is very powerful. So the thing that Peter didn't know or had known and gotten confused and brought them all together, and now Paul is trying to do what he actually said. He was trying to work until Christ, the image of Christ, was formed in them again. Not getting them back together with Jesus, because Jesus got everybody together by his act. This is the formation of that understanding of Christ in you, Paul's teaching. And so he confronts Peter with this issue that we are redeemed and we are justified by the faith of Christ. It is repeated here a couple of times. He lets him know that the only way that you can become a sinner is if you build back the old way again. And you don't become a transgressor in God's eyes, you become a transgressor in your own eyes. And he let Peter know that, as he was telling him, Peter, I do not frustrate the grace of God. Which is Paul's, what Paul was telling Peter is that he did frustrate the grace of God. He set it aside. That's what the word frustrate means. It means to make it null. It means to void it out. For if righteousness comes by the law, then Christ is dead in vain. So now he has completed his sermon. He's completed his rebuke of Peter. He's pointed out the problem. And now he begins to address the people at the church. And that starts in chapter 3. So, Daniel, why don't we start there And we're going to go slow, folks, because we just cannot afford to read over the top of this. And the reason we can't is because we have been taught this does not say what it says. So we've got to slow down and see what it really does say. So take us through this first verse and see what we've got here.
Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1. O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed among you as crucified?
Now, the interesting thing is that's all one question. So what we have here is comma, comma, question mark. A chameleon. I'm sorry. I just revealed my boy George fetish here. which boy George is probably about my age now. So, geez, that's a terrible thing to think, isn't it? So, O foolish Galatians, comma, who hath bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, comma, before whose eyes Jesus Christ has evidently hath been evidently set forth, comma, crucified among you, question mark. Now, see, we always read that. Daniel read it as a statement. I read it as a statement. We all read it as a statement. We're going to force ourselves to deal with this as a question. We don't know. Now, here's the other thing we have to put in here. Is that, of course, these punctuations were added just a few hundred years ago. This was not something that, this is only something that the translators had to come up with because the Greek doesn't have punctuation. Punctuation is a part of translation from the Greek. There's places where the punctuation is just incorrect, but what we're going to do right now, because we've been so beat over the head about what this says and doesn't say, we're going to take what this says and that it is a question, and we're going to approach it from that angle. And, you know, maybe someday we'll be able to go in, and once we get Don back, and we'll be able to tell whether or not this is a question. But right now, we're dealing with a question. Now, his first word is O. and you know what the Greek word is for O?
O?
O. and it simply is a primary interjection. And it is a note of exclamation. O. So he wants them to know. In English, we would probably stretch it out a little bit. Oh, my God.
OMG.
OMG. So really, if you want to change this to modernize it, just put OMG at the first of this. And then he calls them foolish. Now, the term foolish, we use that word. He's such a fool and... that was foolish. But let's look here and see exactly what this word means. Daniel, what do you have in your Greek dictionary there?
Yeah, it sounds like anoitos, something like that. And it means unintelligent.
Unintelligent.
By implication, sensual, foolish, unwise.
Wow. And that comes from two Greek words. The first part of it is exactly of Hebrew origin. It is the first letter of the alphabet. Alpha. It's the word alpha is what it is the first part of the word.
It's like a negation, I think. You know, like we would use the word amuse. You know, muse would be to think, and amuse would basically not to think.
So that's what that is. This is because the last part of the word is noe, N-O-E-W.
Don't you know-y?
Yeah. Don't you know-y nothing?
Oh, Galatians, don't you know-y?
You annoy me. Maybe that's where annoy comes from. And we're just playing. So it just seems to be one of those days. All right. So Paul is calling them unintelligent.
Some of the other translations, of course, oh, foolish Galatians. There was a couple in there, you stupid Galatians, senseless Galatians. But I kind of like the Young's literal translations, oh, thoughtless Galatians.
Wow. Yeah. This is you empty-headed. You got rocks in a box up there, right?
You're just not using your brain.
Exactly. And we need to understand that he is talking specifically to the Galatians for a specific reason. Now, when we went through this first part of this, and he called for the excommunication of James, Peter, and John, we need to, I want to go back to that just a moment. And remember, he was not calling for the excommunication of these guys from Christ. That's not the context. The context tells us he was already being excommunicated from the church at Galatia himself. And he's basically saying, I'm the one getting the boot, and you ought to be giving them the boot instead. So we're talking about the conditions at the church of Galatia, which we will revisit this point, and that is that this church was established by Paul. But if you read the book of Acts, you find out that the believing Jews sent from James, Peter, and John began to infiltrate this church that Paul had established. And there was a mixture in this congregation of Jews and Gentiles in this church at Galatia. There had been people that were sent not just according to the book of Galatians, but where also is recorded in the book of Acts that people were sent to the church at Galatia to try to influence this their thinking. And we know exactly what it was they were trying to do. They were trying to put them back under the law.
Yeah, I just, you know, again, putting ourselves into that situation, I just really think about, like, you know, Paul, number one, you know, going to this place, and he talks later in the book about how much he labored, and he, I think he was the one here where it says, was Christ clearly portrayed among you as crucified? I think that was part of Paul's mission, you know, that was his revelation, that Christ yes. was crucified. Even among the Gentiles, among the Jews and the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. And he worked so hard to almost change their thinking, if you will, to renew that mind, to get them into a new line of thinking. And then Peter, James, and John and their disciples, or as we've been trying to correct ourselves, James, Peter, and John, come in and bring their disciples in. And they, what did they do? Is they brought them back under where Paul just helped them get out of. And now he's saying, aren't you guys thinking? Are you yeah. not using your head? Have you totally lost what we've been working on for so long to get you to this freedom?
And to have departed, he's letting them know you'd have to be completely, you have vacated the process of thought. Hmm. You're just not thinking.
Wow.
You are not thinking. And so he asked the question, who has bewitched you? And there's nothing that I see in that except just a single word from the Greek. And then he wants to know who. The word hath is not in the Greek, who bewitched. You know, if you're translating King James, you have to put a hath in there, though, right?
Yeth.
Yeth, or it's not even King James. So who, what, why bewitched you? How did this bewitching take place? Now, the only thing I know about Bewitched is it was a nice little TV program with Her last name was Montgomery. I can't remember her first name anymore. And that's what we know about Bewitched. But this word, I think it's interesting. The very first definition that I have here is to malign. And it says, i.e., by extension, to fascinate by false representation. Wow. So Paul's continuing this false representation. This isn't just wrong representation, it's false representation. And the term to fascinate, and then of course is translated as the word bewitch. I don't know if this is found anyplace else. Let me look and see if this term shows up.
As you're looking, I was in the Greek Linear that I have, they expound a little bit more on the word, and they say the meaning is to bewitch a person frequently by the use of the evil eye and with evil intent, and it can be translated to practice magic on, or in some senses it was called black magic.
Mm.
I mean, I think I read one translation once that said, who put a spell on you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it was so non, where they went from where Paul was teaching them to where they went was so nonsensical that he thought you must be under a spell. If you can't clearly see what I was showing you, and now you're going back under something else, someone put a spell on you. Someone fascinated your thinking with something that's not even real.
Yeah. Mm. And it's a deliberate, it's very deliberate that the bewitching is not something that just somebody else with a good idea has come along and kind of rendered what Paul had taught as negating what Paul taught. It's very deliberate. This was psychological warfare, if you will. They went in with the intent to not just present a different way, but to seduce people to think that what they had learned from Paul was incorrect. Again, and the reason we're doing this is we Daniel and I both became very interested in picking up the feel of the day. You know, what must it have been like in Jerusalem and Galatia in those days? This was, quote, Paul's church, if you will. And for him to know that they had come in and done this. Now, see, the thing I would like to do is go back and study Paul's travels during this time. There's a pretty good map of his time and where he went. And I'm just wondering if Paul was out of town. I wonder what called him out of town. Did they call him into Jerusalem for some reason so that they could send these people in and begin to undermine his work? Was it just they took opportunity that was presented to them that they saw an opening and got in? Or did they plan this opening? The words that are being used here would suggest that this was not just taking advantage of a situation where he was gone, but may have even set up the situation where they could come in and get this done.
And that fits the context here because, you know, earlier it talks about how they came in. They came in stealthily to Paul and Titus and Barnabas. And so there was a lot of sneaking around.
There was sneakiness going on, and Paul is repeating this time after time of how that they were deceptive and how they did this. This was not a straightforward. This was a behind the background. They did not want public confrontations. They did not want to debate the matter. They wanted to come in behind everybody and introduce a thought that they didn't have to defend.
You know, and as I was reading Acts last night, I saw one very good thing, and we know this about Paul, is anytime Paul was allowed to speak, people shut up. because they could not argue with him. I mean, when he brought on trial, I mean, he was so smart, and he outsmarted everyone every single time. I mean, he was just, the brain on this man was absolutely phenomenal. And they had to sneak around because they knew if they stood in front of him that he would outthink them.
and
it would make sense. It would make sense. That's why I think he's saying, why are you so thoughtless? I mean, because it makes perfect sense what he was saying.
Yeah, I think one thing that would be fun would be to go through all of Paul's places that he was brought in. You know, he was brought before King Agrippa. He reasoned with King Agrippa and won. Goodness, with the Romans, remember that's when he got captured out in the temple and then brought out, and they would have killed him until the Romans. And then they found, you know, he pulled out the I'm a Roman citizen card and demanded that his voice be heard.
Yeah. And then after that, they brought him before the council, and they had the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and he brought up the fact of the resurrection.
Yeah.
Again, to totally take the focus off of him, and they got into arguing.
and he snuck out the back door. So
exactly.
They're back there arguing about whether or not you speak in tongues or not. But this man was a genius. And I remember noting so clearly that in Acts 15, he was asked his opinion. But in Acts 21, they never ask him his opinion at all. James knew better than to ask him his opinion because he knew he would lose. So that's when you have a irrefutable. Let me say it this way: people show you that your position is irrefutable by the fact they don't try to refute it. Now, we are refuting the presumptions of the teachings that are in the Mirror Bible, also in Grace Global Seminary. We are refuting those. We're refuting the definition of sin. We're refuting the assertion that God was never angry. There's many other things, but we would like to get just these two things settled. We have described to them what it is that we are refuting, but they've never described to us what they refute at all. Now, they'll do it generally, but they don't ever ask us any questions. We do ask direct questions. Please show us where this says this. Where did anybody teach what you're teaching in the Bible? Oh, the Bible. Oh, that thing, you know. And they have to completely discredit the Bible that they then turn around and quote to give validation to their teachings. So it's just a bizarre situation. It's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. You know, it's not going to happen. They feel they owe no one an explanation for their stance. This is our stance, and we need no explanation. But I disagree. We need you to explain yourself. Why? Because we need to be right? Has nothing to do with being right. Prove us wrong. You know, we'd like to know if we are wrong. We can't know that we are wrong if you don't point out where we are wrong. And when somebody comes up with a doctrine, well, I just can't believe anybody that would think that God was ever angry is just stupid. There, anybody, how could a loving God ever? And they've done this to the point where that they've whitewashed the cross to mean almost nothing other than a revelation, because God wouldn't be a part of that. God would never do that. We've pointed out why that position is incorrect, and we maintain that it is incorrect, and that it does what Paul said that these guys were doing to the gospel. They're making it void. They're not making the gospel of effect. They are making the gospel of no effect. The difference is, we don't have anybody trying to destroy our lives because of this conflict that we have with the teaching. We have no conflict with the people. Our conflict is with the teaching. And when you have a teaching, you really could consider it an honor when somebody questions your teaching.
Yeah.
My God, that means somebody's listening to you if they question you about what you're saying. But these folks are, they express an offense. How dare you question me? That we've seen, over and over and over again. Redefining of sin, totally outside of what the Old Testament or New Testament says about what sin is. You have to redefine everything then. Because if the problem is sin and sin's definition has now changed the entire scope of what the gospel even is. And if sin is only a wrong mindset, then suddenly the work of the cross is just not that important.
Oh, foolish.
Yes. Oh, foolish, fill in the blanks. Now, this goes on to say, oh, foolish Galatians, who bewitched you that you should not obey the truth? Now, Daniel, what is this word obey here?
It's actually the same word that's used that you should. And it's to convince, an argument, a persuasion, to have confidence with, to trust, obey. Mm. So he's basically, I think he's saying, who put a spell on you? Who's bewitched you? Who's persuaded you not to be persuaded of the truth?
Yeah. So now this word obey means obey in our language. You do what I say. That's not really the context of the definition of this word. Because how do you obey truth?
Right.
So like gravity is an absolute truth. It's like, do I wake up and decide whether or not I'm going to obey gravity today? So we know that the term obey as we use it. I might get up and decide that gravity has no effect on me, and therefore I'm going to climb the top of the tree and jump to prove my point. That would be a pretty thoughtless person that I had decided not to accept the truth about gravity.
And I think that's a good picture about what was happening on here. I mean, this was to that degree. I mean, you're not even thinking, you Galatians. Someone put a spell on you that you would think that gravity is not going to have its effect if you climb mm-hmm. a tree and jump out of it. I mean, that I think that's how strongly yeah. he's making the statement to them.
I think you're absolutely right here that they've gone away from something that. It's not your choice.
Yeah.
It just is not your choice. Truth is not a choice. Truth is truth, whether we choose it, believe it, or not. Before whose eyes Jesus Christ hath been evidently set forth. Now, that phrase, hath been evidently set forth, there's five words there, but there's only one Greek word. So it is going to be upon us to stop and see what this one, why they, it took them five words to say one word. And
yeah, so these five words in the Greek come down to one word, and it's prographal. And the dictionary here just says to write previously, figuratively to announce, prescribe, before ordain, evidently set forth. It has a lot of translations like write, right before, right afore, evidently sent forth, before ordain. So it's something that was almost like convinced of before, written of before.
Yeah. So what is, and I think, preordained is probably, since he's talking about the crucifixion, before whose eyes Jesus Christ preordained crucified. That even makes sense in the context here. And so this doesn't just mean you saw it. It means this was a preordained thing that you did witness. You witnessed what was preordained. He's bringing in a lot here to these guys, reminding them that what they saw, this is vitally important, actually, in our atmosphere, that what they saw in the crucifixion was not just something they saw. They saw something that was preordained. They saw something that the scriptures foretold of. This is what they have seen. Now, it's like dealing with our friends in Mere Bible and Global Grace. It's almost like, well, the cross didn't really need to take place. There was another way. If people would have just simply opened their eyes, if people would have been able to see, then the cross would have been unnecessary. Well, if it was unnecessary, then why was it preordained? Why was it foretold? The stretches of dismissing the preordained work of God to try to come up with some of these conclusions is really quite amazing. Like I said, Paul is making sure that they understand that what they saw was something that was told about, something that was preordained, foreordained, and then it says crucified. I can't imagine that the word crucified means anything other than crucified. Selflessness is one of the words. Of course, it was selfless. To impale on the cross. Yeah. So it simply means crucified. The word among you is, the word among is interesting. It's the word in, E-N. It is a, now this is a preposition. So when it says here, crucified among you, Daniel, I just took a break because I found it very interesting that it's the word E-N. But this preposition, it could mean in. So I was wondering if this meant Christ was crucified in you, because it is translated as the word in. But every place that the word among shows up, the context of the way that, and it's all of those are also en, but it also means amongst the Gentiles, amongst this group. Among them, Daniel pulled me back from the edge there because I was really wanting to read this in there. It just sounded so much better this way. We can't go there because that's not what this is implying in the Greek. If we took this, I want to use this as a point to teach about studying. This is how that this has to go. All right. So now I knew that the word en is the word in most all cases in the New Testament. So I went off and was running through the places where en shows up. And boy, it's 12,000 some times that it shows up. I don't even know anymore, but it looked like "in" meant "in," "in," crucified in you, and that was getting exciting. But Daniel took the word "among" that it was translated into, and went down through that. And every place that the word "among" is used to use this, it also is the word "en," but the context validates that this would be more, would signify that it was among, he was one of the group of people who was crucified. This doesn't say anything more like I wanted it to so bad, but it doesn't say that. So remember, as you're doing these studies, I've got friends that are just now getting their Power Bible. And I'm introducing it to them and, you know, how to go through it. But this is one of those points of study. And forgive me for doing this, because I tell you, I've studied a lot and I have done it with and without confirmation bias. And you got to be willing to be wrong. You can't run across something and run with it because it, and then look no further because it affirms what you are wanting it to say. You got to be willing to say, wow, okay, I just went down a rabbit trail that meant nothing. So, and that's what I just did. Daniel saved me.
I was just looking here at a couple different translations, and this might help us kind of look at this end here. The New American Standard Bible reads, "You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified?" So, you know, he's saying, I was with you before, and I gave you this argument before. I wrote to you before about the fact that Jesus was crucified. And did his crucifixion change anything for you?
Yeah.
Or are you going to go back? And, you know, that's the next questions that are coming up. Are you going to go back and go back to where you were before?
Yeah. And again, not only crucified among you, but crucified as it was preordained to happen. So this is a very strong call. Now, this is all a question. So let's read it through once again, Daniel, and read it through with the question.
Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1. "Oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed among you as crucified?"
Wow, very good. So this is a question, not a statement. See, he did the same thing in verse 7 when he was in chapter 2, when we were in chapter 2. All of this is a statement to Peter, but he did ask this question. So I want to read this question just to show you how this is lining up. "But if while we," I read a translation last night that said, "But if while we apostles," but if while we apostles seek to be justified by Christ, "we ourselves are found sinners." So that gives it he's not just talking, he's talking about, you know, if the guys teaching this, if all of us who are spreading this gospel, if we apostles seeks to, let me get my teeth out of my way. "But if we apostles, while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves, us apostles, are found sinners. Is therefore God, therefore is Christ the minister of sin? God forbid." Paul was trying to lay this out to Peter that if this has taken place on the apostolic level, you know, what, and now he's brought it down to the people level. If we apostles are seeking justification through faith and we're still sinners, then does that mean Christ is the minister of sin? God forbid. And now he's approached the people at the Church of Galatia.
So these are big questions that the Apostle Paul is giving to Peter, to James, to John, and now we have the first question that he's addressing to the Galatians church. And Michael, there's about four or five more questions that are yet to come. Mm. And but listeners, stay tuned, and we will continue these questions.
We will, because
questions are the lifeblood of the gospel revolution.
So Paul is injecting life's blood right straight into the gospel revolution by him posing these questions. Goodness, these are wonderful questions. And he not only called them foolish, but down in verse 3, I see he's posing just how foolish are you? Now that we've established that you're fools, established that you are unintelligent, just how unintelligent are you? We're going to find out. We don't know if it's going to take one or two more shows to find out just how unintelligent the church at Galatia was. Well, we do know, because we know the end of the story. they were ultimately some of the most unintelligent people and affected the entire planet by turning from Paul and embracing the teachings of James, Peter, and John.
And so it is. We must leave you, family and friends. If you'd like to know anything about the Gospel Revolution, then call our office on
832-318-9339
and speak to us about how you want to participate. Or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the connect link. You can find us on your favorite social media network, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Please be sure to hit that subscribe, share, and like button on whatever platform you are listening. Now, it's good night from Daniel Rouse in the frozen tundra.
And it's good night from Michael Williams right here in the secret city, where all is well. We love you guys. We hope that this slow crawl feels like we're doing a bar crawl, you know, what they talk about. You know, we're going in here, we have a couple of beers here, we go to the next bar and have a beer there, or maybe have a shot. We're doing a bar crawl, but here we're doing a verse by verse crawl through the book of Galatians. This is a powerful question posed by Paul. We went through it as methodically as we could, and we hope that we're not boring you with this. It certainly is not boring me, because it's worth stopping to find these things out. We know that Paul is bringing them into question of that their state of being unintelligent has come from somebody. Somebody has caused them to become non-thinking people. He tells us who this is. He's already told us who it is that has caused them to become non-thinking people. Now we have 2,000 years of non-thinking people who have accepted the teachings of James, Peter, and John, and have virtually rejected the teachings of Paul. Paul's teachings are sprinkles on the cupcake. It's not the main course in the churches that of the over 40,000 denominations that are out there. He wanted them to know that you not only saw Christ crucified, but you saw something happen that was preordained by God, that this happened and you saw it. You saw a preordained act of God. And we will not keep quiet while others say that the cross is something less than a preordained act of God to redeem the world, to take away sin, to establish righteousness, and remove judgment off of this planet. We won't be quiet.
We sure hope that you enjoyed today's PowerCast. And remember, we'll be here to do the same thing all over again next week. Only
better. Get to verse 2.
Deconstructing religion and barbecuing the sacred cows of Christianity before your very eyes. You are listening to
Gospel Revolution.